degrees.
And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you on this Monday afternoon, along with colleague Bonnie Berman. Good afternoon, Bonnie.
Good afternoon. Happy Monday.
Well, tomorrow's Election Day.
Yep.
And of course, that will conclude the long, long, grueling campaign for the presidency. Of course, the economy, jobs, and income disparities have been at the forefront of the campaigns. Polls vary, but the race is razor close. And with us now is longtime journalist, author, and documentary producer, Hedrick Smith. He's the author of Who Stole the American Dream? And he joins us from NPR in Washington, D.C. Welcome to you, Hedrick Smith. Thanks for joining us for this hour.
Good to be with you, Joseph and Bonnie. Maybe I wish I were down there in that nice warm weather.
It's beautiful, Hedrick. Couldn't get any better than today.
I just came from New York. It's a mess.
Oh, well, in the book you begin talking about Henry Ford paying wages of $5 a day. Outrageous. The philosophy behind that?
Well, the philosophy behind that was something that made the American economy hum for most of the 30 years after World War II, even though Ford said it way back in 1914. The philosophy behind it was the virtuous circle of growth. If you pay your workers well, and Ford was going to pay them $5 a day, which was unheard of in 1914, then they can afford to buy the Model T cars that Ford was producing. More broadly put, there were lots of others. Charlie Wilson, who ran General Motors, in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, and the guys who ran Ford and Chrysler and so forth, they believed in paying their workers well. Their workers then could go out, and their families went out and spent a lot of money. Strong consumer spending is what drives the American economy. The middle class actually are the real job creators in this country in the sense of spending the money that causes business to expand production, build new plants, buy new equipment, hire more people, and that powers another round of growth. So Henry Ford's idea, although a lot of other things that Ford did that were controversial, that idea was latched onto by lots of other folks in industry, and it really made the American middle class the envy of the world by the 50s, 60s, 70s, which is, of course, not true today.
But wasn't a big reason for the Ford wage increase to keep the union away?
Well, part of it was to keep the union away, and of course that didn't work. In the end, the unions came to Ford and to General Motors and to Chrysler, and in fact, the unions were really the strong underpinning of a good, solid middle class living in the heyday of the American middle class, which, as I say, is that three-decade period after World War II, because they made deals with the auto companies in particular. General Motors, Charlie Wilson, the chairman of General Motors, made a deal with Walter Reuther, the head of the United Auto Workers Union in 1948, which became known as the Treaty of Detroit. The treaty, because it brought labor peace after a bunch of wildcat strikes, and Charlie Wilson said, I want to go back to producing cars and making profits. And Walter Reuther said, fine, give us solid wages, slightly rising wages during the life of the five-year contract, health benefits, a retirement pension, and they could make enough money so they could begin to make the down payment and then the mortgage payments and their homes. And that really was the middle-class dream. So Ford may have unintentionally cut loose the very forces he thought he was going to control, which was a kind of a rising expectation among the American middle class and an activism that led to the kind of agreement, not just for, by the way, union workers, but there were many millions of non-union workers in non-union companies that benefited from the General Motors model. It became the model for Ford, for Chrysler, for U.S. Steel, for Bethlehem Steel, for lots of other companies that weren't unionized because all workers and their families expected, and even the business leaders expected, to give the middle class a solid share of the returns of growth in productivity, growth in the economy, growth in corporate profits. And that's not the case today.
No. Can we skip to 1971, what is really a defining moment in your book? Attorney Lewis Powell had a provocative memo. And tell us how that altered the landscape of power in the country.
Well, there are two things that went on starting in the 1970s, and it's really important, and I appreciate your question, Bonnie, to go back to the 1970s, because there's a great tendency today, particularly today, the last day of the campaign, but today meaning this era, to sort of think our problems all began because of the last election or the last downturn, and certainly they were aggravated by that. I don't mean to minimize it, but you've got to go back to the 1970s to understand what happened. And part of what happened was economics, which upset what I was talking about before, and I hope we'll go back to that, what I call wedge economics. But in politics, what happened was there was literally a political rebellion. The business leaders were called to arms by Lewis Powell, who was a very well-known corporate attorney at that time in 1971. He was later named to the Supreme Court by Richard Nixon, sat on the court for 15, 16 years. But Powell was a strong believer in the free enterprise system. And he was actually mistrustful of middle-class power, the middle-class power that was underpinning the middle-class standard of living, the power of the trade union movement, the power of the environmental movement, the power of the consumer movement, the power of the women's movement. All of those were pushing for a better standard of living for middle class. And what Powell said was, this is constricting the field of maneuver. This is restricting the freedom of the CEOs, the bosses of American corporations, to do what they need to do in order to make the most profits for their shareholders and to do the best for their companies. So Powell said to business leaders, you got to get into politics. You got to get off the sidelines. You're the forgotten man in American politics in Washington. The trade unions, the consumer movement, the environmental movement, they're taking you to the cleaners. You need to identify your enemies. You need to go after them, fight them aggressively, pool your resources, particularly your money, which sort of foreshadows the rise of PACs and then the rise of super PACs, which are so dominant in our political campaign this year and the American landscape. And Powell said, get going. And they did. It's utterly amazing what happened. I was running the Washington Bureau of the New York Times back in the late 1970s, and you could see the results. You could see legislation change. You could see deregulation coming. You could see the tax system being changed. We didn't really realize, I didn't realize, nor did the reporters working for me realize at the time, that this had been a result of Lewis Powell's memo, because his memo was secret. It was circulated rather privately by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and the next thing you know, the business leaders of the top 150, 160 corporations in America, the blue ribbon big companies, formed the Business Roundtable, which has now become the most powerful political voice of corporate America in Washington. The Chamber of Commerce expanded its staff. The National Association of Manufacturers moved its headquarters to Washington in response to Powell. The number of companies that had lobbying offices in Washington at the time Powell wrote were only 175. And a decade later, there were 2,425, 50,000 people working for business trade associations. Business lobbyists outnumbered members of Congress 130-1. By 1980. So there was a revolution, a political rebellion, if you will, on the part of the corporate leaders responding to this memo of Lewis Powell.
That's amazing. How did he have so much power? How did he wield so much power? He was just one attorney. I didn't realize he was a big attorney, corporate attorney, but how did he wield so much power?
You know, I think it's more than just whether or not he wielded power. He, you know, sometimes if you strike a match and it's in the wind, it gets blown out. Sometimes if you strike a match and you're near a gasoline can, it explodes. It's the same match. Well, Powell was the match. And he was striking his match at a time when there was growing sentiment in the business community. This was a business class rebellion. This was not just Lewis Powell's rebellion. This was a movement on the part of business leaders, particularly in the South, in the Sun Belt states, the old deep South of Dixie, and then the southwestern states. They had gone very strongly, the business leaders had, in 1964 for Barry Goldwater, who was strongly anti-union, pro-free enterprise. So there was a sort of a climate down there. But then there were other business leaders who began to see, you know, in the Middle West and the Northeast, that labor unions were getting stronger politically and the consumer movement was stronger politically. And so they were sympathetic to what Powell said. So it wasn't just Powell's power. It was Powell struck the match at just the right moment. And the tinder was there. The appetite for taking power was there. And the message was one that they respected from Powell because he had been president of the American Bar Association. He was a leading corporate attorney. So he was a voice that they believed in, but also the U.S. Chamber of Commerce got heavily behind what Powell said and encouraged these people, business leaders, to get organized. So it was a movement. It's a bit like saying, how did Rosa Parks have so much power when she started the Montgomery bus boycott, and that went on to lead gradually to the civil rights movement, you know, of the 1960s and so forth. It's an event that takes place in the fullness of time. There's a ripeness in history, and that's how you get historical watersheds and historical movements. I mean, look at the guy who immolated himself in Tunisia and that started the Arab Spring. Well, the guy wasn't that powerful, but the mood was right.
Right.
And that's the same thing with Powell.
Hedrick Smith, you mentioned Barry Goldwater. In 1964, did the conservatives lose the battle but then win the war?
Well, I don't think you could say they won the war very quickly. There's no question that the conservatives in 1964 lost terribly. And it isn't just the conservatives. This is real right-wing conservatism. There's lots of conservatism in American politics. There's religious conservatism. There's old-fashioned New England kind of conservatism, Republican establishment, which today would be called moderate conservatism. And then there's the right-wing conservatism that Barry Goldwater represented. I mean, Goldwater was so far to the right that he was very critical of Republican presidents like Richard Nixon and Dwight Eisenhower. I mean, he accused Eisenhower of being a socialist. Now, Eisenhower thought of himself as a Kansas Republican conservative. So this is the far right. So the far right did, yes, they lost the battle then. But they organized very effectively in the 20 years that led up to the election of Ronald Reagan. In fact, Ronald Reagan was the last speaker, famous speaker, in Barry Goldwater's campaign in 1964. So he comes to office and the Republican Party moves a bit to the right, not all the way to where Goldwater was, but with Reagan it moves to the right from where it was with Eisenhower and Nixon. And then Newt Gingrich takes it further to the right when he becomes Speaker of the House in 1994. And then the Tea Party has taken it further to the right now. George W. Bush took it to the right of Gingrich, and then the Tea Party's taken it further to the right. So there's been, over the last almost 50 years, a steady rightward movement of the Republican Party. And the outcome of the elections tomorrow would be very interesting to see, because you've got Tea Party people standing for re-election in a number of congressional districts, not any Senate seats yet, but how the public responds to them will be very interesting. But that's been a powerful influence on American politics, and it goes with this same growing power of the business lobbies who have pushed consistently for lowering corporate tax rates, lowering tax rates on the wealthy, going slow in raising the minimum wage, raising the payroll tax on average workers, getting tax breaks for companies that move jobs overseas and so forth. All those policies have helped the profits and the paychecks of the CEOs at the top, but they've cost the middle class a great deal. The middle class has suffered from what I call wedge economics.
And we're going to talk more about wedge economics. We're speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author, and documentary producer Hedrick Smith on today's Topical Currents. His latest book is Who Stole the American Dream? Please stay with us. We need to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. We're funded by listeners like you and by General Hotel and Restaurant Supply, hosting their warehouse sale and auction today, November 5th, in Miami Lakes. There are chef demos, an equipment auction, and items for foodies and those who love to cook. More info at generalhotel.com. And we hope you'll join us on WLRN TV 17 for Chihuly Outside, a documentary about famed artist Dale Chihuly. It offers a magical glimpse into the conception and installation of Chihuly's artistic outside world. That's Wednesday, November 7th at 8 p.m. only on WLRN TV Channel 17.
Like Topical Currents Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying at facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. We are speaking with Hedrick Smith. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author, and documentary producer. And we're talking about his latest book, Who Stole the American Dream? If you'd like to speak with Mr. Smith or comment, question, the number to call, 1-800 1-800-743-WLRN. That's 1-800-743-9576. Or you can email radio@WLRN.org. That's radio@WLRN.org. So let's get back to the term wedge economics. Please explain. What does that mean?
Well, I love you saying that, Bonnie, because my editor said that when I wrote that. In the first draft of my book, Who Stole the American Dream, she said, where'd you get that term? Did you get that from the Keynesian economists? Did you get that from Milton Friedman in the Chicago School of Economics? And I said, no, I didn't. I made it up. She said, you can't make up a term on economics. You're a journalist. You know, you got to quote the economists. I said, well, I'm looking for a Twitter-friendly phrase that will capture what has happened in the American economy and has cost the middle class so much. And what I mean by wedge economics is this, that there's sort of been a wedge driven into the side of the American economy. If you imagine the American economy as a sort of a tree trunk, there's been a wedge driven into the side of it. And the people on the upper side of the wedge have benefited and profited as the economy has rolled on through the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. But the people at the middle and lower down have suffered very, very badly. What happened was this. From the end of World War II to the mid-1970s, 30 years, the productivity of the American workforce roughly doubled. It rose 97%. And the income, the hourly pay, the hourly wages and compensation of all kinds of workers in America, small business people, people on the assembly line, people in grocery stores, people in auto repair shops, it rose 95%, almost exactly the same as productivity. But the wedge gets driven in the mid-1970s. And from 1973 to 2011, the productivity of the American workforce, which is the real engine for growth and improvement in the American standard of living, rose 80%. But the average compensation of a typical American rose only 10%. Mm. So there's a huge break between that. Corporate profits were going up in that period, roughly on average 13% a year. Wages were going up less than 1% a year. The Census Bureau told us last year in 2011 that a typical male worker made exactly the same amount of money adjusted for inflation in 2011 as in 1978. That's three decades of going nowhere right at the middle of the American economy. Meanwhile, the pay of a CEO of a Fortune 500 company was going up about 350%, and the income of the people in the top 1% of the country was going up 600%, multiplying sixfold. So you've got dead even, stagnation, going nowhere in the middle of America. The great American middle class is going nowhere over a long period of time, and you've got the people at the top making enormous amounts of money. And that is really, along with the political policies that are tilted in favor of corporations, tilted in favor of the rich, is the reason why the middle class is in so much trouble today. And unless we kind of confront that and figure out how to unravel that, we will continue to see the American dream dismantled as it has been over the last 30 years. The kind of policies that we have been following, I'm not talking about just the last 4 years, I'm talking about the last 30 years. And the policies that go back to Reagan and come through both Bushes and come through Clinton, although much less so under Clinton, but somewhat under Clinton, and forward, even including Obama, have not helped the middle class enough. Much more has got to be done. And you can go back and actually see, as I said, this wedge that shows the middle class has stagnated, why people in the upper middle class have made some headway and the people who are part of the rich and the near rich and the super rich and the ultra rich have just made out like bandits.
Hedrick Smith, explain how there have been widespread corporate wage freezes, or pension reductions, salary cuts, and yet record profits.
Well, those two things are connected directly. I mean, the wage freezes have added to the profits. If the productivity of the workers is going up, then most corporations are going to be making more money. Then the question is, the people at the top of the corporation have to decide who gets that additional money and the additional profits. Does it go to the shareholders who own the company? Does it go to the CEO and the top executives? Do they get all kinds of bonuses, which is what's happened? Or does it go to the workers? We just saw Caterpillar Tractor, report about 5 or 6 weeks ago, record earnings for 2011, $4.9 billion, and they imposed a wage freeze on their workers. Well, that $4.9 billion is going somewhere. It's not going to sit in Caterpillar. What they may do is buy back some stock, which will run up the stock price. And since the top executives get paid in stock, they're going to make a lot of money out of that. It's going to go to the shareholders. And the workers have lost out there. That is a typical example of what I call wedge economics. That is precisely why the middle class has suffered badly. Now, part of that is because jobs have been shipped overseas. There's pressure of lower wages in places like China or India or Korea or whatnot. But if you take a look at a country like Germany, which faces the same competitive conditions that we do, they have to deal with the Chinese and their low wages. And then, by the way, more important in China than low wages are the subsidies that they give to companies to cause them to move their plants and their factories to China. Huge subsidies, which our government doesn't do, and the European governments do a bit, but nowhere near as much as China. But you have Germany facing those same competitive conditions as we do. And yet, over the last 25 years, from 1985, German companies like Siemens, like Airbus, like BMW, like Daimler-Benz, which have to compete with other companies of ours and elsewhere in the world, they've raised the wages of German average workers five times faster than in America. And they haven't gone broke. I mean, what we get told by American companies, CEOs, if we pay you higher wages at Caterpillar, we're not going to be able to compete in the world. Well, then how the heck do the German implement and agricultural equipment companies do it? And then the Germans, you might say, well, their wages are higher, so they're not going to be able to export much. They're going to do badly in the world. Well, what's really interesting is to go look at the last decade. From 2000 to 2010, the United States had a $6 trillion trade deficit. That is, we bought $6 trillion more goods, mostly from China, but from lots of places around the world, than we sold to the rest of the world. At the same time, the Germans, who are paying their workers more, and their workers, their average workers, actually make more now than American average workers do, they had a $2 trillion surplus. Wow, that's interesting. $2 trillion surplus with higher wages, $6 trillion deficit with lower wages. That suggests it isn't the wages that are really the thing that is determining profitability and export. And then beyond that, we've been told that we are in a modern 21st century economy, and that means a service economy, mostly banking and finance and healthcare and things like that. And manufacturing is an old-fashioned idea. It's a Rust Belt idea. Forget it, Michigan. Forget it, Wisconsin. Forget it, Ohio. We got to get modern. Well, what's interesting is we have 9% of our workers in our workforce in manufacturing. Germany has 21% of their workers in manufacturing. Now, why should that matter? Manufacturing jobs are the best solid-paying jobs in the middle class, but they're important not just for the middle class, they're important for the whole economy. Middle class manufacturing means jobs for engineers, jobs for designers, jobs for advertising agencies on Madison Avenue in New York, for PR people, for suppliers all over the country. I mean, that's the core of the economy. And you now have American CEOs like Jeffrey Immelt, the CEO of General Electric, or Andy Grove, the former CEO of Intel, and a bunch of other executives who banded together in the Horizon Group saying, we're not going to do well on the world market unless we restore and bring back our manufacturing. Now, there is some improvement. In the last 2 or 3 years, there has been an improvement of about 500,000 manufacturing jobs have been added. And part of that was the auto bailout, in Michigan, in Detroit, with General Motors and Chrysler. They've even promised and they've begun bringing jobs back from Mexico. So it is helping. I mean, people are focusing on that. But that's a long-term task to rebuild American manufacturing. And you've got guys like Andy Grove at Intel saying, look, we're going to lose our advantage in innovation, in research and development, which is what America has always counted on to lead the world. He says, we're going to lose that if we keep shipping manufacturing overseas, because innovation depends on being closely tied to manufacturing. The engineers who design new products, the inventors, have to be close to production because they see how something is made and say, oh, I can think of a better way to make it. So you need to keep those things close together. Now, this is not me saying it. This is not Hedrick Smith, New York Times Pulitzer Prize winner. This is Andy Grove of Intel, who ran Intel for 20 years, who's telling you, we're going to lose our advantage in innovation unless we keep more of our manufacturing at home and rebuild it.
So are people listening to him?
Well,
as I mean, people that need to listen to him.
Well, I didn't hear much about this in the campaign. It is true that both Obama and Romney have said we need to rebuild manufacturing. They mouthed the words. They did say that. So that idea is clearly catching on. That's important. But the next question is, what do you see them say in terms of policies that are actually going to make that happen? I've got some ideas on that, but I didn't hear many of them in the campaign so far.
Again, we're speaking with Hedrick Smith. He's the author of Who Stole the American Dream? He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and documentary producer. Should you want to join in the conversation, the number to call is 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. WLRN.
And first caller, we have listener Joe. He's in Oakland Park. Hello there.
Yes, thank you. This is Joe Berkey. The thing that I wanted to bring up was a similar effect that FDR faced during the 30s when the Keynes principle said that you might have money in places, but people don't always invest the money. So providing additional monies for the rich or the corporations and of those natures does not guarantee any real investment. And in fact, what you've been saying is the fact that they've just been recycling the money back into their own pockets whenever they feel as though they've done a good job of, whenever they've generated profits and not really putting the money out where the people who actually buy products and consume the the production and services will be out there to to spend the money and to continue providing work for everybody who is producing.
But Joe, you're making a very good point, and a point that is not very well understood and is particularly clouded, shall we put it, in the political campaign. We hear a lot of rhetoric that we need to protect the job creators, the people at the top, so they can, the rich can save more money because we need capital, and capital is what enables businesses, large and small, to invest in new plants and equipment and expand the economy. Joe Burke is exactly right. Shortage of capital is not our problem today. Business has been sitting, and my source on this is Alan Greenspan. Business has been sitting on nearly $2 trillion worth of capital for the last 4 years and not investing it very hard. And the venture capital people, there was a story in the New York Times about a month ago, the venture capitalists funds, particularly in California, have accumulated $1 trillion worth of investment money from investors all over the country, including pension funds from various colleges and universities and so forth. They can't find companies to invest in. Let me finish, Joe, please.
Yes, go ahead.
The problem is, I'm just responding to you. I'd just like to get a chance to respond to you. The problem is not a shortage of capital. The problem is a shortage of demand. Those companies aren't investing their money because people aren't going out and spending the money. And they're not going out and spending the money because they don't have it. You've got 27 million people in this country who are either unemployed or employed part-time, wanting to be employed full-time, or they've dropped out of the labor force. You've got 15 million people in homes that are underwater, and they're paying high interest rates that come from the bubble era of high interest rates, 8.5%, 9% during the housing boom and the housing bubble. And if they could refinance today, they could be paying 3.5%, 4%. And if the banks had to refinance them at a lower rate, they'd have all that money. That'd be hundreds of billions of dollars a year in consumer spending power that could go to drive the economy. So, Joe, you're right on. It's a very similar problem to what was going on in the 1930s, except we're not in as bad shape as they were then, thank God.
And we'll take another caller. Next up, it's Don in Miami. Welcome.
Hi, Joe. Hello, Mr. Smith. I was wondering if large corporations and some medium-sized corporations favor high unemployment, let's say in the 7 to 9% range, because they can exploit the fear employees have of losing their jobs. So they can demand more production, get more hours out of them, cut their wages, benefits, lay them off and hire part-time workers, and experience the large cash flow that they have been experiencing. Aren't they swimming in cash because of these policies?
Yeah, well, that's what I was just describing. I mean, I lay out the numbers in Who Stole the American Dream, but yes, you're right. They're swimming in cash. Well, it is a well-known fact, and there's lots of economic analysis done by economists of all stripes that will tell you that wages are under pressure whenever there's high unemployment. If there's high unemployment, it's easy for employers to find workers and to get them, hire them at a lower wage than if there's full employment. When you get what now is called full employment in America, which is around 4-4.5% unemployment, then you find that there usually is a steady trend of rising wages. And you saw that in the late 1990s, which is the best growth period that we've had in the last 20, 25 years. The last several years of the Clinton presidency were really very good years for both the economy and the companies and the workers, partly because there was fairly full employment. And by the way, notice there was also a budget surplus at that time, even though taxes had been raised. And the reason why is the economy was doing well. When the economy is doing well, the tax system generates a lot of revenue for the government. The government has surpluses. And when the economy is doing badly, the government runs big deficits. You know, one of the myths we have here is the tax rate. If you lower the tax rate, you're going to get growth. We hear that again and again and again. And I don't want to be taking any kind of a partisan position here. But if you go back and look at the history, under Dwight Eisenhower, the maximum marginal tax rate in America was 92%. And then under John F. Kennedy in the 60s, Eisenhower was in the 50s, John F. Kennedy was in the 60s, the maximum marginal tax rate was 77%. And we would have, year after year, we'd have growth rates of 3 or 4%. We'd give our eye teeth now to have growth rates of 3 or 4%. With the tax rate, the maximum tax rate right now, at 35% under George W. Bush and under Barack Obama, we've had the worst growth experience of the last 7 years. And by the way, the growth rate has been very bad under Obama, but it was actually a little bit better under Obama than it was under Bush. But all three terms, Bush's first two terms and Obama's third term, all three of those terms have been among the worst growth rates we've had ever since World War II, when the tax rate, maximum tax rate, was low. So lower tax rates don't necessarily generate growth. In fact, there was a study by the Congressional Research Service, an arm of the Library of Congress, that said exactly that. And they were about to publish it in September, just as the campaign was getting hot and heavy. And the Senate Republicans squelched the report and told the Congressional Research Service not to issue the report because it was inconvenient to their politics. But we need to know what the record is in order to make intelligent decisions about what to do now.
Speaking of elected officials, you say that elected officials spend a lot of time fundraising, and we'd be surprised to know how much time. Why isn't there a public outcry, and would it matter?
There is a public outcry, Bonnie. There is a public outcry. If you look at public opinion polls, you'll see 80% of the people, and there are probably a dozen polls over the last, 15 years, 18 years, a dozen opinion polls show that 80% of the American public says lobbyists have too much power. They shouldn't be allowed to contribute to political campaigns. They should be curbed. You get percentages of 60-65% of the public says members of Congress spend too much time raising money. You get 60-65% of the public saying the taxes should be raised on the wealthy, because the wealthy have too much influence on politics. So whenever you're talking about money and politics, the public is pretty clear. They don't like it the way it is. In fact, they also have opinion polls that will say, again, somewhere between 60-70% repeatedly in polls, where people say, the government's not listening to me, Congress doesn't listen to me, opinions of people like me don't matter. People are exactly right. The difficulty is, that's in an opinion poll. And then when you get into elections, people get confused. There's a lot of rhetoric thrown around. They can't sort out who's going to be more in favor of the middle class and who's not. And so there's a lot of difficulty there. But the real problem is that no matter who gets elected in November, no matter who gets elected tomorrow, both to the Congress and to the presidency, the public will go back to its knitting. People will go back to their jobs. They'll go back to their families. They'll go back to their communities, and they'll say, we've spoken. Now the government's going to do what it's going to do. And the problem is that's exactly when the lobbyists go to work, the lobbyists for the special interests. And business now spends $65 for every dollar spent by labor on lobbying. There was $7 billion spent on lobbying in 2009, 2010. 85% of it was by business interests. They go to work while the public's not looking, and they write or change legislation in ways that doesn't agree with what the public says. But back in the 60s, people were angry about that. And so there was a consumerist movement led by a guy named Ralph Nader. And so they organized, and they marched on Washington, and they went to Washington. There was a civil rights movement. They marched on Washington. They said, what's going on isn't right. There was an environmental movement. 20 million Americans went out in the streets or on the malls or in the parks or at universities and had talk-ins and sit-ins and protests and said, we don't like what's going on with the environment. People got active. Nowadays, people don't get active. So when you say the public speaks, well, they speak through polls, and they speak once every 2 years. In elections, but what really goes on, the nitty-gritty of American politics and policymaking, goes on between the elections. And I don't think that unless people start to get off their couches and start to get active, that we're going to see a change in the politics and the policies of Washington, regardless of who gets elected. It's going to be marginal changes, but not a lot. And the reason is the people who are running the show and are in there now, the lobbyists, the members of Congress, the corporate powers that be, the wealthy who are able to get their influence exercised on Congress, they like it the way it is. And so if we say they got to fix it, it ain't going to get fixed. It's only going to get fixed if we say we got to fix it and then we start doing something about it.
Did you feel that the Occupy Wall Street movement had any power at all or any effect?
Well, Bonnie, it's a very good question. Yes, it did have some effect, but I didn't think it was a movement in the sense of the movements I was talking about. Occupy Wall Street was what I call a protest. It was a voice of discontent. People are unhappy. When you said, does the public speak? Yes. I think the public spoke. And when you did opinion polls after Occupy Wall Street, you found that 40-45% of the American public agreed with the protest. And the protest was the 1%, 99% versus the 1%. There's too much money in the hands of too few people. We have a hyper-concentration of wealth and power in this country. We're getting to a starkly unequal democracy, and that's not fair, and it's not good for America. It's actually not smart economics also. Big inequality of income. There are lots of economic studies that show countries that have big inequality of income have slow growth, and the countries that have closer incomes, incomes closer together and a strong middle class actually have better, faster growth. That's what was going on in America back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. But what Occupy didn't do was it didn't translate that discontent into a movement with clear leadership, with clear goals, with the kind of organization that could attract support. I mean, in the civil rights movement, you knew that Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks and all the people who were demonstrating in Birmingham and Nashville and around the South, stories that I covered as a young reporter at the beginning of my journalistic career, you knew they wanted to drink from those water fountains. They wanted to sit at those lunch counters. They wanted to ride in those buses. They wanted to stay at those hotels. They wanted the same kind of jobs that whites could get. In the environmental movement, you know, people wanted the Cuyahoga River cleaned up so that it wasn't bursting into flame from all the toxic chemicals that were being dumped in it. You knew they wanted to get rid of the smog over L.A. You knew they wanted to get rid of the slime in the Potomac River that was so bad that if you put your arm in the Potomac River and pulled it out, it literally would be covered with green algae. It was terrible. So the demands were very clear. They were very specific. And the government responded. I mean, Richard Nixon, a Republican president in the late 1960s, early 1970s, was a big buddy of corporate leaders. He loved to go down to B.B. Rebozo's place down in your neck of the woods, down in South Florida. That's where he liked to hobnob with the CEOs. But Nixon also understood, as a practical politician, that the public was demanding that the government clean up the environment. He was no tree-hugging environmentalist, Richard Nixon, but he established the Council on Environmental Quality, the Environmental Protection Agency. He signed 7 or 8 major pieces of environmental legislation that were passed in response to the environmental movement. So there was something very tangible and organized, and there were masses of people involved. Occupy hasn't done that. Actually, the Tea Party, on the other side, has probably done a better job articulating its goals, getting organized, getting funded, and actually affecting not only the national dialogue about taxes and government deficits, but even the dynamics in Congress. Now, you would think from the way the press deals with the Tea Party that they represent about 55% of the American public. They don't. They only represent about 9%, but it's a very vocal, organized 9%. That is a movement. I'm not making a judgment, yes or no, whether it's a good movement or whether or not I agree with their policies. I'm simply describing that is a movement and the other is a protest. And the protest always has a short-lived lifespan, half-life. It peters out because it doesn't have anywhere to go.
We're speaking with longtime journalist, author, and documentary producer Hedrick Smith. We're talking about his book, Who Stole the American Dream? We'll take a short break and be back with more.
And you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. Back to the show in just a moment.
The 2013 Key West Food and Wine Festival is Thursday, January 24th through Sunday, January 27th. Food and wine enthusiasts from around the country can join locals for Key West's freshest seafood, unique local ingredients, gorgeous weather, and premium wines from around the world. Tastings, neighborhood strolls, wine markets, and seminars create 4 fun-filled days of culinary delights. Details at KeyWestFoodAndWineFestival.com. Brought to you by the Monroe County Tourist Development Council. Orchestra Miami celebrates author Kurt Vonnegut's 90th birthday with an American soldier's tale, the true story of Private Eddie Slovic, the only U.S. soldier to be executed for desertion since the Civil War. This fully staged performance features 4 actors and 7 musicians performing Vonnegut's new libretto and Stravinsky's original score. Performances are Saturday, November 10 at 8 p.m. at PAX and Sunday, November 11 at 7 p.m. at Pinecrest Gardens. Details at orchestramiami.org. And thanks so much for being with us for today's Topical Currents on WLRN. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. And we're speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author, and documentary producer Hedrick Smith. His latest book is Who Stole the American Dream? Do you have a website associated with you or the book?
Absolutely. www.hedricksmith.com. And by the way, Bonnie, it's Hedrick, not Hendrick. So if people are looking for the website, it's HEDRICK. SMITH. Yeah, there's plenty of stuff there. Hey, wonderful video, Face the Nation, Tavis Smiley, PBS NewsHour, interviews, talks I've given, and all kinds of this. There's a very interesting aspect of it, which a lot of people have commented on. It's called the Stolen Dream Timeline. It's a fairly compact sort of timeline on the events that occurred that both built the middle class wealth and political power, and then how all that unraveled. In the book, it's an appendix. It's only about 10 pages long. A lot of people have told me they've gone to the back of the book first and then come forward to read it. They like that feature a lot.
Hedrick Smith, would a true green effort and subsidy and alternative energy research really help push the middle class?
Yeah, I think it would help, but nowhere near as much as rebuilding America's infrastructure. I mean, this is a very interesting issue. This is a huge job creator and a huge boost to American competitiveness in the world if we were now to modernize our ports, our airports, our highways, our bridges, our railroads. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce estimates that we are losing $1 trillion worth of economic growth in America because our transportation system is so out of date. It takes as long. There's so many bottlenecks. There's so many bad places in it. Just one example. It takes as long to move a freight train through the city of Chicago as it does to drive it all the way from Los Angeles to Chicago because the transportation system in Chicago is so screwed up. And there are similar things that are going on in ports around this country and in airports. So if we were to say, let's invest $3-5 trillion. Some of it government money, most of it private money, but a public-private partnership in restoring our infrastructure in this country, it would generate all kinds of jobs. It would obviously generate construction jobs, but it would create jobs for the steel industry to produce the steel girders that are needed and all kinds of other steel equipment that's needed in the building of bridges and highways and so forth, and cement and all kinds of other areas of the economy. So it would have a multiplier effect. And then you have some people say, well, you know, it's really not fair for the government. It's not American for the government to step in and do that. This is really should be the private sector. And remember, I was talking about a public-private partnership. But if you go back in American history, Abraham Lincoln, during the Civil War, got Congress to pass legislation that gave land grants and money to the railroads to build railroads across this country. And it opened up the West and it caused a tremendous boom. Teddy Roosevelt got Congress to spend money to build the American inland waterways. Dwight Eisenhower in the 1950s got Congress to spend all kinds of money to build the interstate highway system, which has been a boon to people traveling and so on. All three of those people were Republican presidents, and Democratic presidents have done it too. Congress gave Samuel F.B. Morse a grant of $30,000 back in the 1830s. That's a lot of money. That'd be into the millions now, to set up the first telegraph system. So the government, and furthermore, the Defense Department, NASA, they've been spending money like crazy. The advantage that America has in the internet, the advantage that America has in the world of space and in the world of aircraft, all came out of defense spending. They all came out of government initiatives. So there's nothing unusual about talking about this. That's been kind of obscured in American history. That would probably do more to help the middle class than almost any other thing, except one other thing I can think of, and I mentioned it earlier, and that is helping the people who are stuck in houses that are now worth less than the mortgage. There are probably 15 million of them, 15 million families, and their house prices are down through no fault of their own. The market collapsed, and it collapsed because Wall Street took us way too far in the wrong way. We went on a financial binge. It was much less individuals that did it than it was the whole financial system that did it. Wall Street's been bailed out. They've been fixed. They're making profits again. Their top people are getting bonuses, but they don't want to turn around and refinance these people who are trapped in these interest loans where they pay 8.5%, 9%, 10% interest. They don't want to refinance them at 3.5% or 4%, which is the current rate of interest, because the banks would make less money. But hey, wait a minute. Where's the fairness in that? We spent a lot of taxpayer money bailing out the banks. Why can't the banks now, can't we say to the banks, okay, it's your turn to bail out the homeowners? It would not only help those homeowners, all of them are middle class. Now, I'm talking about people who are paying their mortgage payments every month. I'm not talking about people who are welshing, okay? I'm talking about people who are paying their monthly payments regularly, and they're in effect losing money because their houses are worth less than the mortgage loan. If you refinance those, it would help the whole economy, because those people would be spending every month $500,000 less per month on their mortgage. And by and large, they're going to turn around and spend that money on groceries, on travel, on gasoline, you know, on all kinds of consumer goods. Several hundred billion dollars a year would add to the consumer demand in this economy. It would be a great growth push. You've got lots of very smart economists who are recommending this, both Republicans and Democrats. But you can't hear that with all the din coming from the campaign. Hopefully, when the campaign's over and we start dealing with the fiscal cliff and then we start figuring out how we're going to get out of this, get this economy growing again, we'll be talking about things like that. But rebuilding the infrastructure, helping out these families that are trapped in these underwater homes, leveling out the tax system. We have a crazy tax system now. You know, companies that move jobs overseas pay a lower tax rate than companies that operate exclusively in America? That doesn't make any sense. I mean, obviously, the big companies have been lobbying for this. This is where the Business Roundtable comes in. They lobby. They're tough. They want it. They like it. They make huge profits overseas. They pay no taxes on those unless they bring the profits back to this country. And if they do, then they go to Congress and say, well, we want a special break. We want what they call a tax holiday and pay 5% instead of 35%. That happened under George Bush. $1 trillion came back from overseas, and the companies paid 5%. So it's smart. under our tax system to do business overseas. But it's not smart for the American economy. So we need to make some very commonsensical decisions here to help ourselves collectively.
And Hedrick, Hedrick Smith, we're just about out of time. I certainly want to thank you. It's been a fascinating hour. We certainly appreciate you coming on our program. We've been speaking with journalist, author, and documentary producer Hedrick Smith. We've been talking about his book, Who Stole the American Dream? Thank you very much, Hedrick. It's
been
a great pleasure.
Thank you, Joe, Bonnie.
And that wraps up today's edition. Our deepest apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary gives production assistance as well. Tomorrow's program examines the crazy quilt of local, state, and federal systems, which govern 13,000 different voting areas. Victoria Bassetti has written Electoral Dysfunction. A survival manual. Remember, you can find free audio archives and MP3 downloads at our website, WLRN.org. Also, there's a Topical Currents Facebook page with lots more information, including author and book links, such as today's. And today's calendar. On this day in 1950, 62 years ago, the TV debut of You Bet Your Life with Groucho Marx. Housewife Phyllis Diller got her start as a contestant. Say the secret word, win $100. And on this day in 1954, 58 years ago, Tropical Storm Hazel becomes a hurricane. It killed some 1,000 in Haiti, 95 in the U.S., then struck Canada, killing 81, mostly in Toronto. One more while we say amen to the Praise the Lord Network. On this day in 1989, 23 years ago, evangelist Jim Baker is convicted of using his TV show to defraud followers of over $150 million. He served a five-year prison term. He was paroled in 1994. Wife Tammy divorced him in 1992. Our theme music, created by the talented Michael Levine. And we leave with a thought from Groucho. Who else? Age is not a particularly interesting subject. Anyone can get old. All you have to do is live long enough. This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
You're listening to